This week on the show, we are looking at key considerations for benchmarking network storage performance, OpenZFS's 2.3.0 availability, and the updates on AsiaBSD Cons conference at the upcoming GhostBSD desktop conference as well. Recovering from an external Zroot is our very own Tom Jones teaching us how to create a new issue in a GitHub repository with Ansible, Doris, Ted Unangst refuses to believe, the date limits in UFS1 having recently got an extension, and more in this week's episode of BSD.
No.
Hey, how are things on your end?
Hey. Well, my end, it's been hot here. It's been 39 degrees for the last 3 days. So that's 39 degrees Celsius for you people over in the US of A. But everywhere else in the world that follows metric, it was 39 degrees Celsius for the last 3 days. So it's actually been very hot. Had to sleep with the air conditioner on last night. It didn't get below 26 overnight. It's been a scorcher of a summer over here. We're still dealing with fires down in Victoria, so
That's the drawback of that there's a lot of bushfires.
Because what comes with this is we get changes and we'll get a storm front that rolls through that's full of lightning and then it starts more fires again, so and there's igniting. No rain. It's like the rain doesn't even hit the grounds. So
and you have to sleep in the fridge basically too.
Yeah. It's cool. Like, you know, last night I put the air conditioner, the other two nights we've put up with not having the air conditioner on, but I said, no, I need a decent night's sleep. So the air conditioner and the ceiling fan went on to keep cool.
Sleep that's affecting you for the rest of the day and it's difficult to catch up.
I did notice I was a lot sharper today. So that is a bonus that shows you that, yes, the 1.2 kilowatts of air conditioning power that was being consumed every hour overnight was worth it. So
yeah, I mean, you collect also a lot of sun because, hey, a lot of sun is shining.
Yeah, well, we get a lot of sun, but unfortunately, I don't have batteries. So you can't use that overnight. No, I've got an EV. That's full. Can't charge any more in that, but so that's been the general weather here. So what have you been up to, Benedict?
Busy. I mean, this semester is coming to an end and the exams are starting next week, so I'm preparing crazy questions for students to solve and exercises for the exam, so that's currently on my plate. Other than that, so far so good. I have a couple of things in the background going on at the department itself, but I can probably talk about that later when it actually materialized, when there's something concrete to talk about. Cool. I've been watching the BSD space recently, some messages going by, and we'll cover that in the show later today, but so far so good.
Excellent. Well, there's been a fair bit happening just in a general sense. This is for you Patreon listeners out there. So, come around 600, we're just trying some things out. So you guys are the only ones that are going to get this conversation. This will be all edited out of the main show. It's still tech related, but there's no articles to go with it. So this is more of our observation that's gone on across the Fediverse, because that's where most of us hang out. I'm still trying to convince Benedict to come and join us in the Fediverse.
That's what this is about. Okay.
Yeah. It's the shame you're in to come and join us. We've all left X.
That is a thing of the past.
Yeah. Our accounts are dead and buried, and there's like so many of us have just torched our accounts and just like, if you see our previous handles, that's not us anymore.
We delete,
deleted the accounts and just left.
It doesn't even have a real underscore Benedict or Jason under before it.
Yeah. The flaming fire that is X. But over on the Mastodon that's been going on. So our friend Stefano, we feature his articles quite frequently on the show, and also we've had an interview recently with him. He started up this service called Fedimeto. So that's FEDIMETEO. So what that's is basically a feed from all the Bureau of Meteorology around the world. Mm-hmm. So he's capturing that and then feeding it using, I think, SNAC2, which is the Mastodon server, and feeding that into people's feeds. So basically, you can subscribe, like follow different things. Like I follow at Melbourne and at Wodonga at Petty Meadow, and that then means that anything that comes and updates on those accounts will actually fall into my feed. So, you know, I get frequent weather updates and that sort of stuff that fall in my feed. So it's quite a good service that can give you what the current temperature is, forecast and things like that. So people say, you know, the Fediverse is not exactly welcoming, and it's really what you make it. So think of the old Twitter where you actually had a fire hose of information, and it was all date-based. So you could basically go through, you wouldn't miss anything. Now it's all algorithm-based and driven like that. So, you know, it's whatever the service, like, you know, X or Meta or whatever, want to pump in front of your eyeballs.
Yeah.
Basically, that doesn't happen on the Fediverse. And people go, oh, there's nothing in my feed. Well, you've got to make that happen in your feed. So fortunately, before all the APIs on X got burnt to hell, you could basically extract your follower list out, and then it would do a search across the Mastodon world to actually go and find those particular users that you're following on Twitter, and then allow you to follow them on Mastodon. So, you know, I had quite a collection that came across, which was really good, because then that meant that my feed was populated with people that I'd follow. And as it got, Twitter got worse and worse, more people came over. People would like retweet, or it's retweet in Mastodon terminology. And eventually, you know, you come across all the people that you were following, and then you build your community up. And so then your feed becomes so full that overnight I get through about, you know, the last 5 hours, and I miss so much that happens on Mastodon these days that I just can't keep up. But it's good because it means that, you know, you can have conversations, that sort of stuff, and the trolls don't find you because
it's a very curated event, a feed, and you only see things you want to see and not something that people push into your timeline.
Correct. And it's like, so people have to go looking for you rather than, you know, oh, let's cause some, you know, friction here. It gets more interaction and keeps people engaged on the platform. That's not how it works. So it means that you can end up floating around in the universe and not actually come across the trolls and things like that. So it's quite good that way. And it's got tools that you can block trolls and things if they do come across you, but I've never had to do that. Back on the Fedi Meadow, it's a really good service. So if you're on Mastodon, go to Fedi Meadow. Hang on, I can, because we're not shooting the show, we can actually take time delay here and not actually cause our editor any particular issues. So the actual service that I'm following is au.fedimeadow.com. There's an EU one, and other ones around the world. So if you go and check fedimeteo.com, FEDIMETEO.com, that should take you to a link page that will take you further on. So, and then you can just follow all the accounts that the places you visit pretty frequently. So it'd be ideal for people that they're going to BSD conferences to be able to find out what the weather is at those places and be able to get a feel for it leading up to their travel to those places. So it's got its uses for us and the rest of the community.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And it's great that people build these kinds of services. And I guess there's plenty of BSD in the background doing all that work.
Oh, yeah. He's got his jails pumped. Yeah. So I think he was looking at a coma server instance. But I believe for all these, he's using SNAC2 because it's simplistic. It doesn't need to have all the tools that you get with a fully fledged Mastodon or a coma or MISKEY instance and that sort of stuff. So he's kept it simple, but it's all running in FreeBSD jails and things like that. So I think each snack instance has its own jail, so we'll be able to keep them all isolated, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's another way of eating your own dog food. Like we talk a lot about BSD, and he certainly has done so. And it's kind of nice to actually build these things and see, hey, this is a viable way of doing this without the usual systems that are typically thrown around. So it's all easy, fairly easy, I guess, and doable with the building blocks that the BSDs provides.
Yeah. So, yeah, we thought we'd share that with you before we started the main show.
Yeah.
And, if you've got feedback about the pre-show, we're quite happy to take that feedback on board. And if there's things that you want us to discuss that maybe not quite right for the show, but you think that, you'd like to hear what our thoughts are that are not on the full public record, but on the sort of a bit more of a private record, we're quite happy to do that too. So send your feedback into feedback@bsdnow.tv. Let us know that you're a Patreon supporter. Yeah. So then that way we know how to answer and where to answer that. So we can have like effectively two feedback sections. You can have the pre-show feedback, and then you can have the real show feedback. So if you're a Patreon supporter, let us know in your feedback that you are a supporter, so then that way we can work out where to put your question and answer. So,
mm-hmm. All right, yeah. Then let's start the official show.
Rightio. Is this where we're going to be quiet now, Benedict? They're going to know the secret sauce now, because we'll be quiet, and then it'll all be edited magically, and then all of a sudden, oh wow, this is when the show starts.
It's like I was behind the scenes when it happened.
Yeah.
BSD Now, episode 598, UFS1 up to date, recorded on the 4th of February, 2025. Ha, I got the year correct.
This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDNow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDNow. And we thank you in advance for that.
Hi, I'm your host, Benedikt Reuschling.
And I'm Jason Tubner.
Hi. Can you believe that 1 month has already passed? It's like over so quickly and we're in February.
Yeah, where's the year going, Benedikt? It only feels like I've still got stuff here that I haven't unpacked from EuroBSDCon, right? And that was how long ago now? I can't believe how much time has passed.
I'm proudly wearing my speaker gift, the scarf we got. So that is certainly looking nice. You have to wait a little. I'm not sure your weather is scarf worthy.
No, not yet.
But you'll get there.
The Patreons got to hear a bit of a conversation in the pre-show where we talked about what it's like down here at the moment. So, it might convince a few more of you to become Patreons for the show. There's more detail. We've got it in the show notes, and we'll talk about it later on in the show. But we had a bit of a pre-show discussion about some of the stuff that's been going on in the community and what we've been up to and what it's been like for us around where we live. So, general chit-chat. So patreon.com, come and join us, and you'll be entitled to the pre-show too.
Yeah. All right. What is available for everyone is, of course, our headlines this week, as always. And it starts with another good article by Clara Systems, Considerations, or Key Considerations even, for Benchmarking Network Storage Performance, written by none other than our producer, JT. So this is about network storage performance. So a lot of things in there. And it introduces with, when measuring network storage performance, it's essential to account for factors like protocols, workloads, and testing tools. SMB, NFS, and iSCSI each bring unique strengths and challenges to the table. Learn how to optimize your NAS setup for accurate and meaningful benchmarking results. So these are the three parts: SMB, server message block, aka Windows file sharing, NFS, network file system, the Unix file sharing system, and iSCSI for exporting storage and importing it as a local storage, even though it's coming over the network. The article goes, when setting up a network attached storage, or a NAS for short, system using ZFS, it's essential to understand the performance users can expect when accessing files. And NAS on the office network, on a VPN, or in the cloud acts as a central hub for data. Its ability to handle multiple users reading and writing files efficiently is critical to its success. Performance testing is a valuable step to gauge how well the NAS will serve its users, but it's not always a straightforward task. Different protocols, SMB, NFS, and iSCSI, handle file operations in unique ways, resulting in their own unique challenges. Workloads vary significantly, and each workload is different. An application that accesses large volumes of small files will need different tuning than video editing software that is streaming a small volume of a very large file. And each different protocol has its benefits. For instance, SMB is optimal for compatibility across operating systems, NFS for rock-solid stability for Unix systems, and iSCSI provides block-level access for virtual machines. However, they also have unique details that need to be considered when seeking to maximize their performance. Before diving into testing, it's important to consider these factors to ensure a meaningful and accurate assessment of your NAS's capabilities. So they start with benchmarking SMB over the network. And what are the challenges here? Using ZFS as the NAS for Windows clients or mixed client infrastructure is typically accomplished through the use of SMB shares. SMB, or the server message block, is a network file sharing protocol that allows applications and users to access files and other resources on a networked computer. Originally developed by IBM and further enhanced by Microsoft, SMB is widely used in Windows environments, though it's compatible with other operating systems. SMB enables users to interact with files and directories on a remote server as if they were on their local machine. Its versatility makes it a popular choice for file sharing in both home and business networks. Crystal Disk Mark is a popular Windows I/O testing tool and can be a tempting method to test SMB shares. The tool has some configuration options that can be adjusted to influence how the test is run. However, it was designed for testing local disks, and its lack of precise control over how the IOs are issued results in varied reliability over the network. It's a great utility for gaining a quick estimate of a system's potential performance, but it should not be relied upon for high accuracy results. Okay, so that's good to know, and they reference also the Crystal Disk Mark FAQ for more details. What are other tools that are in that area? There is Blackmagic Design Raw Speed Test. The BMD raw speed test is especially useful for simulating a media-heavy workload, yet it would not be as reliable for testing other workloads. Then there is the industry standard FIO for testing SMB that they also recommend, and they have covered in other articles. However, there are some special considerations when running FIO on Windows systems. Because of the caching Windows is doing, if you're testing using PowerShell on a Windows box to an SMB share, you will need to use the --direct flag. This avoids interference from the Windows I/O caching subsystem. And Clara would recommend you avoid attempting to run FIO in a WSL environment. The mix of emulation, virtualization, and caching within WSL can produce very unreliable results. The key metrics here are IOPS, latency, throughput from the benchmark, CPU usage by the SMB client, and the OS network stack on the device under test, as well as on the server. Then they talk a little bit about optimizing performance with SMB multi-channel support. The performance of an SMB server and client can vary significantly based on the network's capabilities and the type of workload. Enabling multi-channel support may lead to much greater performance in these scenarios. First, this will have the client make multiple TCP connections to the server, allowing the transfer to be spread over multiple network flows. And second, it can enhance performance in several ways, including spreading the load over multiple queues of the network controller and using multiple network interfaces concurrently, as well as allowing the SMB server to use multiple threads to parallelize I/O operations. And if the network is on a LAGG, link aggregation, IEEE 802.3AD for the nerds. Multiple flows can also allow the load to balance across multiple links and switch ports, offering greater bandwidth. Okay, let's switch over to NFS benchmarking. The matching NFS and ZFS block size is important here. When using NFS to share ZFS, it's important to ensure that the NFS block size and ZFS record size are matched. If they are mismatched, they're can be dramatic results in performance and lead to a lot of penalties that people experience when accessing and writing data to it. There is a separate article. They reference here ZFS performance optimizing success stories. that I think we also covered in previous episodes. So this is good to have read again if you're trying to implement this. The two primary performance issues that can occur are read and write amplification and inflation. What's this about? Write amplification occurs when the physical write to disk must be larger than the logical write, the data that is changing. With the default ZFS configuration of 128 kilobyte records, any changes to files smaller than the record size, such as 32 kilobytes, require rewriting the entire 128 kilobyte record. This occurs even though only 32 kilobytes of data have been modified. As a result, the system uses four times the disk bandwidth compared to a scenario where the record size matches the size of the changes. Same or a similar issue can occur during reads if the record size is 1 megabyte. An application requests only 4 tiny kilobytes of data. ZFS must read the entire 1 megabyte record, verify the checksum, and then return just the tiny, teeny 4 kilobytes the application needs. Subsequent requests for the next 4 kilobytes will typically be served from the ZFS arc, making the impact less significant as the data was prefetched. However, if the application accesses a random subset of blocks, ZFS might end up reading 256 times the amount of data actually required to fulfill those requests. Not so good. What's write inflation? Write inflation is when a single block of a file is updated. ZFS must update the indirect block that points to it. Due to copy and write, it also updates the parent blocks and the parent blocks of those parents all the way up to the root to the tree. For each single block of change, ZFS updates metadata blocks that track it, sometimes multiplying or multiple times for data redundancy. So a 32 kilobyte change could trigger 3 to 5 additional 128 kilobyte writes, especially if changes happen far apart within the file. This inflation increases disk usage and slows down performance, particularly when changes are scattered across the disk. And they talk about configuring NFS threads for better performance. There are a few other details to keep in mind when testing an NFS share. For example, the default number of ZFS threads can vary across Unix operating system. On NetBSD, the default is 4 threads. FreeBSD has 8 threads per core. And OmniOS, the default is 16. Lastly, most Linux distros have a default of 8 threads. Okay, that's important to distinguish. And they talk a little bit more about key differences between NFS 3 and 4. They also have a separate article on PNFS, the parallel NFS implementation on FreeBSD. They also link to that article they covered a couple weeks ago. Then there is benchmarking iSCSI over a network. Similar to NFS, it's important to ensure that the iSCSI block size and ZFS record size are matched. The same read and write amplification and inflation performance issues can occur. These are mismatched. And with iSCSI, the situation can be much worse, as typically the iSCSI block size will be 512 bytes or 4 kilobytes, the sector size. There are a few other minor considerations to keep in mind. For example, jumbo frames, while critical to performance in the past and still helpful in very specific situations, these days are often more trouble than they are worth. Modern NICs using TSO, the TCP segmentation offloading, which passes data to the NIC in 64 kilobyte chunks, iSCSI-specific offload features and hardware acceleration do not require reconfiguration your entire network to get the desired performance. So they talk a little bit about each of these if you want to check out the full article, but they conclude the whole thing with final considerations for optimizing network storage. Most good storage benchmarks of the network start by determining the performance of the storage without the network directly to the server. The baseline value that this creates helps determine how much performance is being lost to the network. It also identifies configuration or topology changes that could reduce the network's impact on storage workloads. One of the most important factors to consider when benchmarking of the network is the additional latency. Packets having to traverse the network will increase both the amount of time and the variance in the time, the jitter. Some of this can be overcome with additional concurrency to keep more data in flight at once, yet depending on the workload, that may not be possible. If you're reading a database, knowing which rows you need to read next will not be possible without the results of the current read operation. And with the right design, planning, and tuning, the network can be made to achieve your performance targets. As with all things, it's just a series of trade-offs between throughput, latency, complexity, and cost. If you're looking to design your next storage and network infrastructure, consider Clara's storage design and implementation solution.
That's a good article. There's a couple of things I sort of want to cover before we move on. The MTU section that they talked about, which was labeled jumbo frames. So that's correct. You don't really want to have your iSCSI traffic anyway moving across segments from layer 2 to layer 3. So you really want to be keeping your iSCSI target and your initiator on the same segment. It can be a VLAN or a separate isolated switch, but you want to keep that in the layer 2 segment. The TSO will give you the performance that you need without having to do MTU adjustments. And I have seen points where if you traverse across too much of a network anyway, your MTU can be fiddled with depending on the layer of network and the control, if it's in your control or out of your control. So yeah, keep it layer 2. Don't worry about using jumbo frames, and utilize TSO, which came around, I think, FreeBSD 12. We saw the implementation of that. We didn't have to worry about FreeBSD 11. This is, I come across a heap of TSO issues when I went from 11 to 12 for Beehive. So I'm well versed in that. So there's also another one. I wrote an article for the BSD Journal around iSCSI a while back. So you might want to go and check that out, because there is actually some design or configuration considerations that you need to take into account when you actually are using ZFS-backed iSCSI storage, and how it presents itself to an initiator. So go check my article out. It's a plug for myself.
And what a good one, actually.
Yeah, and go and check those, because I actually made myself go and find those sharp edges, so you didn't have to scratch your head wondering what's going on. And you know, NFS, that's another one. It's like NFS is one of those ones where it really needs to die, but it won't die. And things you need to consider is, like, you know, a lot of clients, as it talks about in the article, are NFS 3. So, you know, take that what you will. NFS 4 is good because you've got more ACLs and that sort of stuff. But overall, NFS, as we've talked about in feedback in the past, doesn't support file locking. So depending on your application and what your use case is, NFS might not be the fit for you. And that's where iSCSI would probably be a better choice in that situation. So other than that, there's some really good stuff in this article. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Multi-channel support in SMB. So that's on a typical single thread, if you don't tune your SMB protocol, your single threaded will basically top out probably around about 15 gig mark, 15 gigabits per second, not gigabytes per second, gigabits per second. So, you know, on a single thread on a 10 gig on modern hardware, you're pretty well okay. But this is where, you know, you want to have multi-threaded support, so you can use LACP or lagging that you might have for dual connection to your storage network. So, yep, that's a very good feature, nice to have, and configure it up. It's there, it's available, so use it. So good work there, JT. Thumbs up, mate.
Yeah, good. And we're staying a little bit in the storage area.
Yeah, staying in the storage area and still in the headlines as well, I'd like to say. Saw the release of ZFS 2.3.0. There was a release notes that came out from the OpenZFS project, and they're excited to announce the release. And, you know, we're all excited that it's come about, because there's some really, really good features in this. A lot of stuff, a lot of things that people have been waiting for years for. And it's finally now in a production state where we can all use it. So key features in OpenZFS 2.3.0 sees the RAID Z expansion, adds a new devices to an existing RAID Z pool, increasing storage capacity without downtime. So this is where, you know, we have always longed for the ability to go, oh, my Z pool is, or my pool is basically full, and I need to add more storage to it. And it really basically required you to ZFS send all your data sets across to something else, pull down the pool, recreate the pool, and then send them all back again. Now with the RAID Z expansion, means you don't have to go through that particular process. So it's good to have. Remember, there's going to be some performance issues until, you know, the rewriting of data has gone on the whole pool itself as it balances itself out. But it means there's a lot less work for administrators, especially when you've got, say, 100 terabytes that you need to add more storage to. It's a really good feature to have. And for home labbers, it's probably the number one feature that everybody's been looking forward to.
Yeah, because it gives people option to migrate slowly to a new array type without, you know, backing up, destroying, and recreating the whole thing.
Mm. Yeah, I've had to do it many times with different things here, and even in a business setting, I've had to do it. So this is a really good feature that's going to save a lot of people a lot of time. Also, we see as key features is fast dedupe. It's a major performance upgrade to the original OpenZFS deduplication functionality. So deduplication is got its benefits, but the original implementation was actually quite poor. It actually went against you anyway. So I think Jim Salter and gave a bit of a talk on this on one of the Clara webinars that was with Alan and Jim at not that long ago, actually. So, you know, go to their webinar page on the Clara Systems website, and they go through this particular functionality. So then you can get bit more of an insight into how the fast dedupe is different from the original dedupe, and some considerations you need to take on board when you're using any sort of dedupe with ZFS. So that's a good feature too. We also see direct IO, which allows the bypassing of the ARC for reads and writes, improving performance in scenarios like NVMe devices where caching may hinder the efficiency. So we know that NVMe is right on the PCIe bus for super fast access. Sometimes ARC read and writes will introduce latency into that because you've got storage that's basically working nearly at the speed of the RAM, but if you've got to do multiple transactions and push data to RAM and read it from RAM, then you've got that extra latency instead of just committing it straight to storage that can handle the performance that the CPU is looking for. ARC can actually hinder that. So it's good to see that is also a feature. JSON output for most used commands. So this allows you to generate machine readable output from certain commands that you run, the ZFS and ZPool commands. This will help those that are writing scripts that need to pass certain output of commands to do automation. So JSON gives us the ability to do that, whereas the other output that we're traditionally used to is human readable output, but machines can't interpret that, or you've got to do some huge amounts of awk to get the results that you're looking for. So JSON just makes it so much easier to get that data. We see long name support. So supports the file and directory names up to 1,023 characters. Yes, I've hit this limitation, the previous 255 limitation, because people have got Windows shares and they want to move that to an archive server, and the archive server is ZFS running Samba, and they try to drag the stuff over, and bam, they hit issues because they've got huge long file names, huge long directory names. The long file name support on ZFS now fixes that particular issue. So again, another thing that I look forward to in 2.3. We also see bug fixes, a series of critical bug fixes addressing issues reported in previous versions, numerous performance improvements throughout the code base, and it sees supported platforms now with Linux kernels 4.18 to 6.12. So that basically covers you for all your Linux enterprise distros, as well as I think Fedora 41 is covered in 6.12. So that's good to see that there's that support for all the basically main distributions and Linux kernels that are being used in production today. But for us, for what we care about, FreeBSD has seen 2.3 be installed into 13.3. So if you're a 13.3, which is end of life, the 13.4 is now out. 13.4 is your go-to. So you've already on 2.3 if you've upgraded your Zpool, of course. And FreeBSD versions 4.5 14.0 to 14.2 is also supporting 2.3.0.
Yeah.
There's further information on the release notes, so I highly recommend you going to our show notes and clicking the link and checking out the rest of the release notes there. But if you go over to the openzfs.org website, you will actually see the instructions, if you're a Linux user, how to install it. But FreeBSD users, enjoy the ride.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, if you upgrade your pool, don't forget to upgrade your boot blocks so that also the pool gets recognized, especially when you boot from that pool.
Yes, and also do a gpart before you go to upgrade your boot blocks, because people get caught out all the time when they don't realize they're using UEFI and they go and blat the boot blocker straight over the over the partition that's holding UEFI, and they just get the prompt that they can't find an operating system. So, yes, make sure you do a gpart show to make sure that what type of booting you're using, and make sure you populate the UEFI shim or your boot block accordingly.
Okay, time now for the news roundup this week. Remember last time Jason and I were recording and we mentioned a bunch of conferences going on, and we were not sure about what Asia BSDCon was about, and now we have official word from them in their announcement mailing list. They said the following about Asia BSDCon. So a couple of people were wondering, is it actually happening? Or when is the call for paper opening and things like that? So here they write, "Dear Asia BSDCon supporters, we know that many people have been wondering about the status of this year's Asia BSDCon in Tokyo, Japan, and we apologize for the lateness of our communication and the message it must convey. Due to a confluence of inferences or circumstances, financial, logistical, and personal, we are unable to hold the conference as planned this year. We deeply apologize for this, gomenasai, for this, and are sad that we will not be able to meet in Tokyo this year as we had planned. Asia BSDCon has weathered financial downturns, an earthquake, and other very real challenges since it was started 20 years ago. For the conference to have a vibrant future, some things must change, and we are undertaking these changes presently, and also going to be asking for help from the community." So there's no Asia BSDCon 2025. This is the immediate cancellation announcement here. They also tell us about creation of a transition organizing committee, including Liwen, Philip Pops, George Neville Neal, and Sato-san, Hiroki Sato. And there is a call for recruitment to the 2026 Asia BSDCon program committee. George Neville Neal has agreed to head that program committee and recruit people by volunteering now, who greatly aid their work for the 2026 conference. And they also call for financial support of the conference. The biggest challenge to Asia BSDCon has been inconsistent funding, sometimes due to internal issues within the project and at times due to the vagaries of global finance, including fluctuations in the rate of exchange between the currencies used. As many of you know, Asia BSDCon pays for travel and lodging for speakers, and this is a significant part of our costs, and we do not see that changing. Travel to Asia for many of our speakers is costly and cannot be evenly borne by all speakers. The conference needs to have a cushion of at least $100,000 in a bank in order to ensure that people and vendors are paid on time and that the conference is actually happening. The transition organizing committee started discussing on how to solve these situations. If you want to get in touch with the program committee or want to join that, like I did, by the way, please contact committee@asiabsdcon.org directly if you can help by joining the Asia BSDCon program committee, recruitment of speakers, or financing if you want to sponsor. This is always the two priorities when running a successful conference. So the website will be updated this weekend, and they already have, with these details and the transition committee. We know this may all come to a bit of a shock to the community, but we believe that this is a welcome or a good reset to the conference, and that makes it stronger in future years and give it the ability to provide excellent papers, talks, and hallway discussions for another 20 years.
Yeah, it's a bit of sad news about the conference, because I knew a few people were warming up to it, and a lot of people actually got in contact with us to ask when we call for papers to be able to submit a paper to the conference. So it's a bit of sad news that's come about. There is some people that have already purchased tickets, and I believe this conversation's about just having a little get together in Tokyo for those that are already committed to travel. So I believe there was some, I can't remember where I saw it. I've had so much email in the last
few people.
Week.
Yeah. Meeting, but I bought tickets.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there is something happening. We will look for that email and bring it to you in an upcoming release of the episode, if I can find it, to sort of read it out. So if anybody out there is listening and is already committed to going to it, at least, you know, we might be able to let people know what some other people are planning to do. So it's a shame that this has happened this year. But, you know, we've got to look forward to 2026 now for Asia BSD Con, and hopefully we get that off the ground and we can all get together and catch up. I certainly would like to get to 2026. Let me tell you, I miss going to conferences, and when I get a chance to, especially the Asia ones, they're closer for me. So yeah, I'm looking forward to getting back to Asia in either in over in Tokyo or
Taiwan, when they switch back and forth again.
Yeah. So fingers crossed, and good luck to the organizing committee, and let's get it on for 2026.
Yep. So that is this news. And we heard about another conference, interestingly, the GhostBSD Desktop Conference. What's that about?
This is an article over on the Phronix website, Benedict, and it says the year of the BSD desktop, ? There's going to be a BSD desktop conference, at least. And the story goes, technical BSD conferences aren't quite as common as the many Linux conferences these days. For the BSD conferences that do happen, they tend to be more general in nature than carrying a desktop focus. But being announced this week was GhostBSDCon 2025, as a forthcoming developer conference largely focused on desktop use of this FreeBSD-derived distribution. GhostBSDCon 2025 was announced as a virtual conference taking place 29 March 2025 on the Berkeley Forest FreeBSD Lodge. While hosted by the GhostBSD Project, the virtual conference will be around developing, deploying, and using desktop systems based on any BSD variant. This is the first time GhostBSDCon is being put on virtually or otherwise. GhostBSD, as a reminder, is a FreeBSD-derived operating system employing the Mate desktop for a nice out-of-the-box BSD desktop experience. Those unfamiliar with GhostBSD can see our many past GhostBSD articles and visit ghostbsd.org. For those wanting to learn more about GhostBSDCon 2025, as the new BSD Desktop Conference, can find the initial details via this week's call for papers for this virtual conference.
Okay, yeah. So as a kind of a in-between or replacement conference for Asia BSD Con, this might be for some people of interest if they are in the desktop area.
Yeah, it sort of goes hand in hand with this. Currently, there's work going for a special interest group for FreeBSD. So you'll probably see on the FreeBSD YouTube channel, there's been the recordings for the last two special interest groups for desktop BSD. So utilizing FreeBSD as a base and building that base up to be more desktop orientated for laptop and desktop users. So there's a fair bit of work that's happening in the desktop space for FreeBSD. It's sort of been a bit of a sideshow in the past because a lot of developers either use Macs or the operating system's been used for big deployments, you know, in the big deployments that we've talked about previously on the show, you know, like the Netflixes rooms, and the PlayStations and that sort of stuff. So there hasn't been this focus around the desktop, but there's been a bit of a renaissance with the direction that Linux is going. People are looking for alternatives to get ownership of their computer back. They, you know, every time that, you know, all these things, shims get put into different operating systems, you look at the Windows 11 show, it's just like, you know, I was going to use a swear word there, but I'm trying to keep this G-rated. The amount of stuff that they've jammed in that, and then the amount of stuff that's being rammed in Linux, people want to have a simple computer back to just do computing things that they used to do. And, you know, FreeBSD can be one of those like lifeboats for people to come back and reclaim control of their computer to continue, you know, doing what they need with their computer. So there's some exciting stuff happening, and I'm looking forward to seeing what the outcome of that over the next 12 months is going to be. So yeah, good on GhostBSD for putting something on and getting that, you know, that fire burning.
Yeah, that's definitely good to have. And here goes an article by our very own Tom Jones, recovering from external Zroot on his own blog, adventurist.me. And Tom
Tom doing something? Oh, geez, well done, Tom.
You mean outside of BSD? He has time out of BSD now?
I thought this would be an article about Dragonfly BSD.
Yeah, that's the next article, his installation instructions for Dragonfly
BSD. Yeah, we're still waiting for that.
It's kind of becoming a running gag on the show. But let's jump to his article now. So his favorite terrible computer, a separate link to another blog post he wrote, has been locking up after VM panics. And I need to panic a VM a lot to find a firmware crash. The hard power cycle reboot loop is taking too long, and I'm done with it. More annoyingly, it's also hard locking up copying the VM off the machine. This forced a trip to the attic, a reinstall of my large memory host, which for reasons had a 128 gigabytes NVMe, which is silly on a machine with 128 gigabytes of RAM. That is fine. I can pull the NVMe and drop it in an enclosure and just copy locally. For a ZFS disk on a machine with an existing Zroot, this turned out to be very painful. Somehow, no one has written down how to do this either. Normally, zpool import takes a name as an argument, but it can take a pool ID as well. If you're using a machine with ZFS on root, then you will already have a pool called zroot, so trying to import your pool from an external drive will fail with the name already in use. Finding the pool ID can be done with the D argument to zpool import. It's a long number if you have to type it up. This takes a device to use as a pool, so he has a test output from a zpool import, and that displays the ID. Now you can use the pool ID instead of a name with zpool import. So you can do zpool import -R/MNT. So this is the alternative root mount. Then capital N, then F, the long ID of your pool, and then lowercase t, old Z root. With this command, I ask zpool to import with a different root location, capital R, so I don't clobber my existing file system. Do not mount anything, -N, and use the ID and a temporary name for the pool, which is the lowercase t, old Z root. With the pool imported, you can find your dataset and mount it with ZFS list and mount -t ZFS. Oh yeah, good to know about this. And in case you need it, it's available here in our show notes for reference.
Yeah, this is a good guide. You know, I haven't really thought too much about to document this down. I've come across this particular problem quite often when I've got to move machines and things like that. This makes it really simple for everybody to follow along at home, and hopefully we'll help them out. It'll probably be slurped up into an AI data set before you know it, and then you'll just type it into your generative AI and it'll tell you exactly what Tom just said.
Even we aren't safe.
Yeah, so if you see this ID for a pool come up somewhere in as an example when ChatGPT gives you an answer, and you know where it's been ripped from.
It's Tom's pool, yeah.
Yeah.
We're still laughing, but it's all happening in the background as we speak.
Yes, it is. Yeah, so moving on to the next article. We've got it's a blog post from JP Menz, and it is labeled "Create a new issue in a GitHub repository with Ansible." So Benedict and myself are big Ansible fans because it achieves so much, and you don't have to remember stuff. You can just run the Ansible scripts again and it fixes your problems. So it goes, I want to create a new issue on a GitHub repository using Ansible. GitHub's REST API docs have a sample which works with curl, which I adapted for Ansible's URI module. And there's some playbook code there for Ansible. And I just like hard coding secrets in code, so I use a lookup which tends to read the token I'm using. So it reads the token as the actual playbook plays, and the result is expected. So then he's got the his issue opened and the example of what it looks like on the web page for GitHub. So note, labels is an array of labels, and new labels are automatically added by the API. And that's the end of the article. But it's really good. It's good to see that you can just like bang some stuff out pretty quickly into other platforms like GitHub to from directly from the command line of your FreeBSD or OpenBSD or whatever BSD machine. So well done.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then we have Ted Unangst, which we haven't covered in a long while.
Wow, Ted, I haven't heard from Ted for ages. He disappeared off Mastodon with his Honk creation and he's back. He's got a post.
His blog, flag.tedunangst, has been, active, but I think we did such a good job of covering some of his latest exploits, and so this one may be a reintroduction to Ted. And so this goes, stories I refuse to believe. The internet is filled with stories that purport to teach us valuable lessons or something about how the world works. And they're really important because they really happened. NASA spent millions of dollars designing a space pen, which was really foolish when they could have just used a pencil like the Russians. I think not as many people believe that anymore, but it's still floating around out there. Here are three more stories which will never decompose because it's more fun to retell this tale than question why. The first is Third Burgers. In the mid-80s, restaurant chain A&W launched a third pound burger to compete with McDonald's. But the initiative failed because Americans are too stupid to understand fractions and thought 4 is bigger than 3. Oh, okay. I think people like the story because they know fractions. So if everyone else gets it wrong, that affirms they're smarter than everybody else. Ted's words. So the source for the story is a paragraph or two in Taubman's 2007 autobiography, written more than 20 years after the events in question. He was the owner at the time and inventor of the shopping mall. He was also convicted of price fixing in a separate incident, which is one part ad hominem and one part billionaire, which will say or do anything to be right. It's not the product which sucks. It's the customers who's stupid. For context, A&W had been not just declining, but dying when Taubman took over the business. By the time customers allegedly had to do fraction math, most of them probably had their own opinions. I also question the business acumen of only doing focus group testing after rolling out this all-in sales strategy. Wouldn't you first do some local testing before going nationwide? The biggest question I have is, given your recent discovery of Americans' innumeracy, how do you not pivot to selling fifth pound burgers? And I can totally believe they did a focus group and one dump said that the burgers sounded too small. It's a funny anecdote and might have bubbled up to the CEO. But what did the other 99 people in the survey say? Then the next story is about Target Dad. Target ran an ad program to so detailed they would know you're pregnant before you do. An outraged dad storms into the store manager's office, demanding to know why they're trying to hypnotize his high school daughter into getting pregnant with diaper ads. Then a few days later, he apologized. Target was right. She was pregnant. What sets me off is the Disney perfection of the story. Dude comes into the store to complain. Happens every day. But the story would be meaningless without the follow-up apology to confirm the truth. And then the mouse pulled the thorn from the lion's paw. Oh, wow. That's a nice reference there. Feedback at bsdnow.tv if you know what the reference is about. The story source wasn't the manager, however. It was the assistant to the regional manager or something who somehow happened to be hanging out in the manager's office for both events. Don't they have their own job to do? And recorded the conversations to provide verbatim quotes to the reporter. I wouldn't expect a flyer from Target to have been preserved, but the article is pretty vague on the dates when the super specific ad program was running or when the dad got mad. Did the assistant to the regional manager affect the program change? It's supposed to be a cautionary tale, but who canceled the program before the tale was told? This seems more like one more hypothetical in an article filled with hypotheticals that got lost in the telling. The whole article is built up on tales of the dark secrets of advertising, but when it comes to verifying, there's no confirmation or anything. Even the author's original source has gone silent after feeding him a bunch of stories. There's also what I'll call the null hypothesis story. This incident could have happened even without any tracking. Mail coupons entirely at random, you're going to mail some diaper coupons to teenage girls. We should therefore expect some mad dads regardless, but this one anecdote doesn't tell us if we've exceeded the mad dad base rate. So that's another reason I think it's made up. If you researched complaints received by Target managers, you'd unearth so much insane crap this story would never register. Then there is the brown candy story. Bury some small detail in your contract, then check if the vendor did it, and you'll know if they did the rest. People really, really love this story. But did it happen? Well, of course. Look, here's a photocopy of the contract. But did it work? I'm supposed to believe that upon discovering a brown candy, Van Halen went out and double-checked all the pyrotechnics and whatnot. When? How much time is there between arriving at the backstage ready room and their performance? Isn't the opening act already out there? How long did they delay the show? If the check was that fast, why not just always perform it? Why would anyone assume that the snack subcontractor was or has any relation to the munitions subcontractor? This is like the age-old advice that you should never buy a lawnmower from salesman with a crook tie. There's a bit more to this story, but overall at the end summary from Ted is recency. What all these stories have in common is they came to light to explain something that happened long ago. By the time the story was out, the sources were hard to find, and who really cares? But did you hear about the Air Force AI drone that turned around and killed its operator, which turned into a simulation, and then it was a thought experiment, and then it was just a made-up story? Or the botnet of Bluetooth toothbrushes that destroyed a bank? That was pretty quickly clarified into a hypothetical of a mistranslation of a miscommunication. What's different is that these events allegedly occurred now and people asked questions. If either of those examples appeared in a book published 20 years from now, they'd be accepted without question.
Oh yeah, cybersecurity was wild back in the 20s. I remember that toothbrush botnet took down a lot of our services.
Instead, we'll be reading a book about refrigerator botnets in 20 years, and somebody will question if it really happened, and the internet will tell them, of course it happened. That's where Silicon Valley got the inspiration from. Okay.
That's a honorable mention, low background steel.
Yeah,
good to see Ted doing his reading that might not be computers, but it's good to see him back blogging.
Yeah, he also wrote a couple of articles about coding and a new grep implementation that doesn't suck, but that is up to you to discover on his blog roll.
Yeah, when you started this post off, I couldn't stop laughing. And I was having a private chuckle to myself. It was quite funny. The third burgers, that was gold. But interested. It brought back memories about NASA spending millions of dollars of trying to make a space pen when they could just follow the Russians to use pencil.
It's like, hard could it be? You
know, many, many decades ago, I did scuba diving. And, you know, when you take your tablet down, not your tablet, your iPad tablet, no, just your writing tablet. And all we used was just the graphite 2B pencil. And that's, you could write messages to each other and it was fine. It's like, there was nothing special about it. So it's like, you know, pencil does the job.
Yeah,
why invent something else?
In different environments.
Yep. The final news roundup of the week is a commit message. So this is around the defer 2038 date limit in UFS1 file systems to February 7, 2106. So we can guess who committed this to the source tree, and it was Dr. Kirk McCusick, and it happened on the 31st of January 2025. So there was some code committed to get over the 2038 issue that was still existing in the UFS1 code, and it's to bump time T from 32-bit to 64-bit. So at least you'll be able to use UFS 1 now and not have to worry about it in our lifetimes. So it'll be somebody else's problem. So well done, Kirk. And it's good to see that there's still love being given to the older file systems that exist inside our favorite BSDs.
Yeah, so UFS 1 got this fixed. UFS 2 is safe. It's fine with that date problem. And it's good to, again, have the little bit of love given to that old version. If it's still around somewhere and people cannot upgrade for whatever reason to UFS 2, so they also get this date extension.
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud. You can be sure that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what is duplicated. It then assembles the data into compressed blocks and encrypts them with your local private key. And this key never leaves your system. The data is then uploaded into the cloud. Even if someone is able to obtain your data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code and make sure it does what we say it does. And Tarsnap has bug bounties, so that if you find errors in the code, you can get paid for helping make the software better. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse not to have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more.
And that brings us to the end of this episode. We have, feedback.
I slipped this into the show notes. We were getting ready for the show, and I said to Benedict, where's the feedback? And he goes, what feedback? And I go, well, we got an email from Nelson. It's like, where's the feedback? And he's gone, I haven't included it. So, madly with my non-Git skills, trying to put it into GitHub for the show notes. But we got it into the show notes. So Nelson BB has provided some feedback. And it goes like this. Comments on the latest episode of BSD Now indicate puzzlement over the status of GCC support for Udder. The issue is that two decades ago, about GCC 4 or so, parts of the GCC compiler for Ada were written in Ada itself. This meant that you need an earlier version of GCC to build the newer compiler, and the bootstrap problem exists ever after. This has also happened more recently with the support for the D language. If OS distribution always supplied all languages that GCC supports, this would not be an issue. However, some major distributions fail to do that, among them CentOS, GNU Linux, and some members of the BSD family. FreeBSD 15 has a package, GCC6 OX 2018/0516_3,1, that provides Ada but is a 9 major compiler generation behind, making it a difficult job to bootstrap Ada support for modern compiler versions. Modular 2, GM2, has been supported by GCC for a few years now, but many distributions fail to supply it. At Utah, I routinely build new GCC releases every few weeks on our major servers, and my goal is always to include every compiler that GCC can produce. Apple does not supply any GCC compilers, and it has been several years since out-of-the-box GCC releases will build on Mac OS. There is some work in this area to fix that problem, but it has not been integrated into the master GCC source tree. Yeah, interesting. It's good to see that people still dive into the weeds with compilers to keep them going, because if it's clear here that if you've got a gap, you're not going to be able to bootstrap the newer ones because you need the older stuff to bootstrap the newer stuff. So thanks very much for that, Nelson, and the highlighting the Ada stuff in itself. I think I've mentioned on previous episodes, there's a podcast called Advent of Computing, and the old compilers and Ada have been mentioned on the podcast in the past. So if you're bored with listening to us, which I hope you're not. And after this podcast, you can go and check out Advent of Computing and give them a sub and have a look at the back catalog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some good stuff in there and good training ground if you want to flex your programming muscles. And it's always good to say, look, I solved a couple of those, gave me a bit of thinking time, and I have a much better understanding of a computer science problem, if you want to frame it that. And overall, you have a better approach to these kinds of problems, or at least see what issues are out there that people can solve. And that is really now the end of this episode. Really, really?
That is. But before we go, don't forget to check our show notes out at bsdnow.tv. And if you've got any questions or feedback or suggestions for the show, please send them into feedback@bsdnow.tv. And we will either get back to you very quickly on the email or get them prepared, ready for the show so we can read them out on air.
Yep. Enjoy the week. Until next time, we have an episode, spoiler alert, next week. And there we go. Enjoy.
Catch you later.